everyone, and welcome to the Healthy Skeptic Podcast. My name is Danny Roddy, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and creator of thehealthyskeptic.org, a blog challenging mainstream myths about nutrition and health. Chris, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm a little stressed out. We're moving. I hate moving. So, but with the baby coming, we need a little more space, and so we're playing that game right now, looking for a place, and it's stressful for me. I don't like it.
Moving is not fun. That's why I got rid of most of my possessions in my early age and sleep on a mat on the floor.
Yeah, maybe I should try that. I don't know if my wife would be really into that, though. We'll see.
My girlfriend at the time was not happy with it.
Yeah, I've been there. Been there, done that. But at this point, a house sounds better. How's it going for you? What's up?
Nothing much. Busy with school, work, blog. I just had an interview with Jimmy Moore, which went really well. I told myself I wasn't going to listen to it because I thought it was so bad, but I finally did, and I thought it was okay.
Yeah, I never listen to my interviews or podcasts for that same reason, but let's get to it.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to do some questions about specifically Hashimoto's disease, leaky gut, and autoimmunity to kind of specialize this podcast.
That sounds good.
So let's get to it. Okay, the first question is from Bonnie Snide, and her question starts with, I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's disease a few years ago. I currently take a natural thyroid supplement that is formulated at a compounding pharmacy. I recently started living the paleo lifestyle. I have been eating a lot of leafy greens, but making sure to cook them. I was told that raw cruciferous and raw spinach were not good for me, but cooked was okay. Now I am reading that I should totally avoid cruciferous and spinach. Is this true? If so, what vegetables am I supposed to eat? I love leafy greens. Help.
It's a good question and one that comes up a lot. I haven't seen any evidence that cruciferous vegetables, raw or cooked, really play a significant role in thyroid disease. The studies I've seen suggest that there's no relationship at all between thyroid cancer and cruciferous vegetables. And if anything, the compounds in cruciferous veggies may actually protect against thyroid cancer. And then I've never really seen any convincing studies showing an association between cruciferous veggie intake and thyroid disease. There are some animal studies that suggest that cruciferous veggies suppress TPO, which is an enzyme in the thyroid, and other aspects of thyroid function. But those are in really high doses that humans aren't likely to obtain from food. I mean, you'd have to eat like a lot of raw broccoli for that to happen. And I think most people are going to have a pretty bloated stomach before they get to the point where, you know, they can depress their thyroid function with raw broccoli. So I say go on eating the cruciferous vegetables. If you want to be extra cautious, it's probably a good idea to cook them.
I think it was on your blog. Somebody was... or maybe it was Dr. Krasian that suggested you throw away the goitrogen list and you add in the gluten list because all the foods with gluten are much more deleterious to the thyroid than any goitrogen would ever be.
That's exactly right. I wrote that and I probably, you know, heard it from him originally. But I went home, you know, after that seminar, I think, where he talked about that. And I did a lot of research on PubMed about cruciferous veggies and thyroid. And I just didn't find anything that convinced me that there was a connection, you know, at the level that most people are eating them. I completely agree that if you want to talk about dietary concerns with thyroid, gluten is way more of a concern. And I'll come back to that in a second. But there are a lot of environmental goitrogens that and when we say goitrogen, we just mean an environmental factor that can cause goiter, which is a sign of depressed thyroid function. So there's heavy metals, there's pesticides, there's plastic compounds, dioxins, PCBs, there's medications, there's like antibiotics, NSAIDs and anti-inflammatories can be potentially goitrogenic, diabetic drugs, statins, cholesterol-lowering drugs, et cetera. So those probably play a way more significant role in terms of their goitrogenic effects than any foods do. And then gluten, well, we have gluten and iodine, which we haven't mentioned yet. There is a correlation between gluten intolerance and autoimmune thyroid disease. It's pretty small, but we have to keep in mind that the testing for gluten intolerance has been really limited up until very recently, and we're going to see an explosion in detected gluten intolerance, because now we can test for not just alpha-gliadin and transglutaminase, but we can test for all the other forms of gliadin, all the 8 types of transglutaminase. We can test for glutenin. We can test for WGA. We can test for, deamidated gluten or gliadin. And, you know, there's like over 100 compounds in wheat, and people can react to any of them. So, you know, when the studies say there's only like a 5% correlation, well, yeah, that's just for alpha-gliadin and transglutaminase, the ones that are elevated in celiac. But if you've been, you know, reading any of the articles on my blog lately, you know that celiac's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to gluten intolerance. And for every one person that's diagnosed with celiac, there's 8 people who are undiagnosed. And that's just celiac. We haven't even got into all the intolerances to the other proteins that I just mentioned. So in my clinical practice, I see a huge correlation between gluten intolerance and thyroid disease, and I see huge benefits when people remove gluten.
So, Bonnie, you can keep eating your raw spinach. You just don't eat the wheat.
Exactly. And one more thing on that. Be careful with iodine, because although in the developing world, iodine deficiency is the primary cause of hypothyroidism, and in the U.S., it's Hashimoto's, which is, of course, the autoimmune thyroid disease. And iodine can trigger and flare up Hashimoto's. So if you've got Hashimoto's, or even if you don't know you have Hashimoto's, what the research shows is that about 8 to 9 out of 10 people with hypothyroidism in the U.S. do have Hashimoto's. So you pretty much assume that you do if you're hypothyroid. Unless you've had your antibodies tested and you know that you don't. So be really careful with iodine, excess iodine in supplements and in seaweed and stuff like that.
Agreed. Awesome. Okay, let's go to our next question. This one is from Sherry. I have a question. I was diagnosed with hypothyroidism in 1997 and I've been on Synthroid since then. My doses started at 75 micrograms, then escalated to 100, then to 125, and here in the last 6 months I've gone from a steady 200 micrograms to 212 micrograms, and just recently to 250 micrograms. I am concerned to why the sudden increase in my dosage. I know that the levels must require this, but why? I've just wondered if you could advise.
Yeah, that's another common story, unfortunately. The increase in dose obviously indicates some kind of decline in her thyroid function, but the question that she's asking is why? Why is it declining? Why is it declining so rapidly? Well, I just mentioned Hashimoto's in the last question, and as I said, most hypothyroidism is due to Hashimoto's in the developed world. The reason a lot of people don't even know they have Hashimoto's and that most conventional doctors don't test for it is that it doesn't really change the course of their treatment. So there, you know, if you go into a doctor and you have hypothyroid, your T4 or T3 is low or your TSH is high, they're basically going to give you thyroid hormone replacement. That's the end of the story. So they don't really care if you have the autoimmune version of it. They don't really care what's causing it because it doesn't affect the outcome of their treatment. But the problem with that approach is that the underlying cause of the problem isn't being addressed. So the immune destruction that is destroying the thyroid gland and therefore destroying the thyroid's ability to produce thyroid hormone can just go on unchecked. And as that immune destruction intensifies, more and more the gland gets destroyed and the thyroid is less and less able to produce hormone, and then the dosage of the medication continues to go up and up. So
the first time I heard that, I was just flabbergasted because it's like you have an autoimmune disease and the course of the treatment doesn't change at all. It's just the same protocol for whatever is going on with your thyroid. And it just astounds me.
Yeah, it's wacky. I mean, part of the deal is that for other autoimmune diseases like Crohn's or rheumatoid arthritis, they've got things like prednisone, you know, which are really potent immunosuppressive drugs that they do use to treat. Of course, it doesn't address the underlying cause, but it does something to dampen the inflammation. But in the case of Hashimoto's, in their mind, the risk benefit is too high for those drugs. Like with Crohn's and rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and some of those other autoimmune conditions, they're potentially fatal, you know, so the stakes are higher. And so they're willing to use the sort of carpet bombing drugs. But with Hashimoto's, they're not really willing to do that because it's generally, I mean, it can be a really nasty disease, but it's rarely fatal. So, they're not willing to bring out the big guns, and they don't have, you know, conventional medicine doesn't really know what to do otherwise with autoimmunity. They're totally behind the research, which we'll talk about later, I think. So they just don't know what to do. So it's better for the, you know, they just don't test for it because they don't know what to do with it. But what should be done is the autoimmunity itself should be addressed, you know, and the inflammation that the autoimmunity causes should be addressed, because inflammation decreases thyroid function in so many different ways. Number one, it depresses conversion of T4 to T3. You know, so I see a lot of people in my practice with normal T4, but low T3 levels, and they've got systemic inflammation. So that's one thing. Inflammation also causes thyroid receptor site resistance. So you could have enough thyroid hormone circulating around your bloodstream, but the receptors can't, you know, don't want it or can't let it in. It's similar to insulin resistance. And then inflammation can also depress pituitary function, so that the pituitary is not adequately communicating with the thyroid gland and, you know, telling it to produce enough hormone. So basically inflammation inhibits thyroid function at, you know, at every turn. And conventional treatment or conventional testing doesn't look at it, doesn't take it into consideration. They just give you the thyroid hormone and call it a day.
Yeah, so Sherry should seriously reevaluate whatever she's consuming. She doesn't say what she's actually eating here, but the fact that she's going up on her meds is not a good sign.
No, definitely get some help, because the long-term consequences of that are not pretty.
Okay, so let's jump to our next question. This one's from Claire Harris. My doctor is suggesting a partial thyroidectomy on the right lobe because multiple nodules are growing. Having tried kelp, which only managed to send me hypo, and I am wondering, really, what can I do about this? Can I avoid surgery, or is this actually necessary?
Well, you know, of course I can't answer that question. In some cases, surgery is necessary, especially if there's a malignant growth. But that's, you know, an evaluation that would have to be made, knowing more about her case and with her doctor, of course. What I can say is that, you know, just hearing the little bit about kelp, of course, has me thinking about iodine. She said she got worse when she started the kelp, and I'm guessing that she has Hashimoto's, and that the kelp, which has iodine in it, probably triggered her Hashimoto's, you know, and made it worse. One thing that I always advise patients to look into when they're facing any kind of, well, I advise almost every patient with Hashimoto's to look into this anyways, but certainly if they're facing surgery or something like that, is a drug called low-dose naltrexone. Of course, I'm not a doctor. I don't prescribe this. It's not within my scope of practice to prescribe medications, but I can certainly educate patients about the available options. And low-dose naltrexone is a really, really exciting medication in the treatment of autoimmune disease. And basically it's very low dose of a drug called naltrexone that was used for many years with opiate withdrawal and alcoholism. And what happens is if patients take a very low dose of this of naltrexone, it provides a blockade of the opioid receptors in the brain, and it kind of temporarily tricks the brain into thinking that opioid levels are low and it better hurry up and produce more. So, and then because it's such a low dose, it leaves the body, so it doesn't continue to blockade the receptors. And then, but the effect has already happened, where the brain, you know, kicks in with this extra production of opiates. And what we know is that opiates play a really big role in regulating the immune system. So, with autoimmune disease, it's basically an imbalance in the immune system. Really, kind of an oversimplification would be to say that the immune system has two primary sides or arms. One is called the Th1 side, and this is cell-mediated immunity. This is like our first line of defense. Like if you get exposed to a bacteria or a virus or a parasite or something like that, and you produce T cells, or the T cells go and attack that pathogen and kill it. That's, you know, that's our first line of defense. The other side of the immune system is the Th2 system, and that's antibody mediated, which means, you know, this is what happens when you get exposed to one of those pathogens, and then the B cells start producing antibodies to it, so that later on, if you get exposed to that same pathogen again, you'll be immune to it. Is this making sense so far?
Yeah, this is highly interesting area of the immune system. Continue, because I have a lot to add to it.
Okay, so then what happens with autoimmune diseases is one of those sides becomes dominant. In some cases, both sides become depressed or both sides become dominant, but usually one side becomes dominant. In Hashimoto's disease, I think it's about 70% Th1 dominant. So it's like the immune system, which should be in a kind of dynamic state of balance and adjustment, just gets locked into one of those sides of the immune system being dominant. What naltrexone or low-dose naltrexone does is it stimulates the production of Th3 cells, which are called T-regulatory cells. And the job of the T-regulatory cells is to bring the Th1 and Th2 sides of the immune system back into balance. So naltrexone so far seems to be the most potent way of stimulating the T regulatory cells and bringing the immune system back into balance. There are other things that stimulate T regulatory cell production, like vitamin D, for example, glutathione, which is the master antioxidant in the body, and then things like acupuncture have actually been shown to stimulate T reg cell production. So, you know, getting back to Claire's original question, I would definitely look into low-dose naltrexone, try to find a local physician in her area that works with it. There's a growing number of people that do, because there's so much exciting research being done in this area. And I've seen dramatic results with it with my patients.
Chris, with your patients, have you seen some of them getting worse by taking specific supplements that boosted Th1 or Th2? Like unwittingly, if they were just taking kind of a garbage bag of supplements, where...
Yeah, that can definitely cause problems. I know that some practitioners take a really specific approach where they test the various Th1 stimulating supplements and various Th2 stimulating supplements, and then try to figure out, you know, remove all the ones that are stimulating the dominant side and then emphasize the ones that are stimulating the non-dominant side. So far, my approach has been to really focus on the T regulatory cells, the Th3. And there's a couple reasons for that. Number one, I think the immune system is really, really complex and sophisticated, and we're just beginning to scratch the surface of understanding how it works. And my approach is always more focused on supporting the body and doing what it knows how to do best than it is like to kind of get in there and mess with the wiring ourselves. You know what I mean? And so I'm a little wary of that approach, even though I don't deny that it works and it can work. I'm just a little wary of it myself. And so I've chosen to focus more on the T regulatory cells and getting people, making sure everyone's got enough vitamin D and glutathione and referring them out. I have someone I refer out to for LDN, low dose naltrexone. And that seems to produce really significant changes. And then if necessary, beyond that, we'll look at the TH1 and TH2 stimulating supplements. But I think there's a lot we haven't learned yet about what which substances stimulate which pathway. So I'm a little reluctant there.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting area of the immune system.
Yeah, this is super exciting because, you know, up until recently, I mean, this was low-dose naltrexone. A guy named Dr. Bihari started to use it with HIV, I think, in the late 80s. But for quite a while, it was not really well known, and there were no clinical studies that had been done on it. And now we have, you know, good clinical trials. There was a trial done on Crohn's, on LDN for Crohn's disease out of the University of Pennsylvania. I can't remember the name of the doctor, Jill Smith, I think. Sorry if that's not correct, but 70% remission rate for LDN with Crohn's, which is, I mean, if you know about Crohn's disease, that's a remarkable result. Like, there's no other medication that gets even close to that, and there was almost no side effects in the study. The only side effect was, you know, mild and usually temporary insomnia that's a result of the opioid blockade that happens during the night from taking LDN. But this is big stuff, because as autoimmune disease, you know, continues to increase, we need tools, you know, to be able to deal with it. And while I'm not usually a fan of taking medications over the long term, I think the benefits that can happen with LDN far outweigh any potential consequences that a very, very low dose. You know, we're talking about 1.5 to 3.5 grams, and the normal dose of naltrexone is 50 grams. So so it's a really low dose and very well tolerated by most people. So it's exciting, definitely.
Awesome. Okay, let's go to our next question. This one's from Jan. As someone who was diagnosed about 2 years ago with hypothyroidism, I take Synthroid daily. What would I do better on Armor? I am a nurse, but I never see it ordered. Always Synthroid, she says. And she's talking about Armor Thyroid for the listeners.
Yeah. So another good question. There are a lot of considerations when deciding what thyroid medication is best. And once again, disclaimer, I'm not a doctor. This is not medical advice. But again, I can educate people on what the options are. And I think it's good. If you've got hypothyroidism, it's really good to understand, you know, what the options are and why you might need one medication over another. I wish that more doctors did this kind of education, but it doesn't seem to happen very often. So you got to know why the thyroid function is depressed, first of all, like, and how. Is, for example, is T4 normal or is it low? Is T4 normal and T3 is low, which would suggest that T4 is not being converted to T3. And, you know, for those of you that don't know, T4 is inactive in the body. It needs to be converted into T3 to become active. So you could have normal T4 levels, but if you're not converting T4 into active T3, you're going to have all the symptoms of hypothyroidism. So people who have this pattern, which I have to say is the most common pattern in my clinical practice, I see a lot of people with fairly normal TSH or maybe a little bit high, totally normal T4, right smack in the middle of the lab range, or even a little bit in, you know, towards the upper end of the lab range, but then their T3 is quite low. This is common, and you know, going back to what I said before, inflammation is one of the main reasons that T4 doesn't get converted to T3, and inflammation is, you know, just ubiquitous in the modern world now. So these folks who are under converting T4 to T3, if you give them a T4 medication like Synthroid or levothyroxine, and they're not converting T4 to T3. You're going to have to use a whole lot of that medication to reach the destination, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you might need to use like twice or three times the normal dose in order to get them, you know, if they're only converting a very small amount of it. So those people might do better on a T4, T3 combo like armor. Armor is a combination of T4 and T3 in a certain ratio that's, you know, close to the right ratio for humans. And so obviously that would be a better choice for people,
Chris,
with this kind of pattern.
I'm sorry. Chris, do you have any opinion on the recent change in armor's formula?
There wasn't. That's kind of a little bit of a myth. The formula wasn't changed. I think it's always been 4.22 to 1. I can't remember the exact ratio, but the ratio is still the same. What changed were the fillers.
Okay.
And that's a good segue into the next consideration with thyroid medication is the fillers, because a lot of people with, you know, Hashimoto's is an autoimmune disease. A lot of people with hypothyroidism have Hashimoto's. Autoimmune disease is often caused by leaky gut, and which we'll talk about more, I think, later in the show. And when you have a leaky gut, that means you're often reacting to certain proteins in foods, like especially corn and gluten. And so these medications oftentimes use things like cornstarch, and some even use gluten in their fillers. So I think what happened with that formula change had nothing to do with the ratio of T4 and T3 changing. It had to do with the fact that some people were fine on the previous formula. They weren't reacting to the fillers in the previous formula, but when it switched to the new formula, they started reacting to the fillers. So that's another consideration. And then even beyond that, you know, some people with Hashimoto's produce antibodies to actual thyroid hormone, the T4 and T3. That's not common at all. It's rare, but it happens. And in those cases, a synthetic thyroid hormone will be better because they're less likely to react to it. So there's a lot of considerations, as you can see. It's not so simple.
Yeah, we always want to kind of have a format of exactly what to do. But I mean, for all the reasons you just listed, it seems like you have to really specify case by case basis.
You do. And it, like I said, it'd be great to find an endocrinologist that you can work with and who's willing to explain all of these, you know, nuances to you. But I think what happens with some practitioners is they kind of also want it to be easy, you know, and just to have, oh, I like I've heard practitioners say, I really like Synthroid, or I like armor. And I'm thinking, you know, what do you mean you like armor or you like Synthroid? I mean, it completely depends on the patient's presentation. You can't just like one or the other because it comes in a cool package or something, or it's easier to use. Or I mean, and I'm being a little bit facetious and kind of a jerk, but it's a concern. It kind of makes me mad, so I'm just mentioning it. I know people maybe have some success with one more than another, but that's no excuse not to keep looking deeper. So.
Agreed. Okay, let's get to our next question. This one is from Mary Russell. My son is currently 14 and fighting autoimmune dysfunction. He was on antibiotics for a year straight when he was 8, and a year later developed what we now know to be a rare autoimmune problem. Do you believe that the overuse of antibiotics and the destruction of his internal gut flora could at least contributed to his current autoimmune problem?
Absolutely. It's so sad. I'm so sorry to hear about that. It's just, you know, I think autoimmune disease is the disease of the 21st century. It's really unfortunate because it's difficult to treat. We're just kind of fumbling around with it. It's so far incurable. You know, we don't have an idea of how to really get rid of it forever. So it ends up being something that we just manage as best we can. And for anyone who's dealing with autoimmune disease, they know how difficult it can be to live with, and you know, just how challenging it is. So getting back to the question, you know, if I say autoimmune disease is the disease of the 21st century, then I think leaky gut is going to be the pathology or the pathological mechanism of the 21st century.
Totally. And
what I mean by that is we're just learning so much every day about how important intestinal barrier integrity is to health, and how severe and diverse the consequences are when that gut barrier becomes compromised. So just a few basics on the gut. I like talking about the gut. It's because it's such an amazing system, an organ system. It's home to we have over 100 trillion microorganisms in our gut. So that's pretty much an incomprehensible number for most of us. But just to give you an idea, that if you $1 trillion bills laid out end to end would stretch from the earth to the sun and back with a lot of miles to spare. And you could do that 100 times and it would give you some vague idea of what 100 trillion is. Now, the human gut contains about 10 times more bacteria than all of the human cells in the entire body. So I like to remind people of this, but you know, we're actually kind of more bacteria than we are human if you look at it that way. And you know, some people kind of hypothesize that we evolve basically as carriers of bacteria. Like we're doing their bidding more than they're doing ours, in other words. And of those bacteria, there's over 400 known bacterial species. So I'm just trying to give an overall picture of the incredible vastness and diversity and complexity of what's going on in the gut, and that we've only really begun to understand its importance. But here's what we know so far. We already know that gut flora, you know, healthy gut flora promotes normal digestion. It provides protection from infection. It regulates our metabolism, can actually even influence things like appetite control. And there's some really interesting research about how gut flora is connected to obesity and diabetes. And it comprises more than 75% of our immune system. So the majority of our immune system is in our gut. That's really important to understand. When the gut flora gets screwed up, it causes diseases ranging from autism and depression and other behavioral disorders to autoimmune conditions like Hashimoto's, Crohn's, and ulcerative colitis, and type 1 diabetes. And the list is very long. That's just a few highlights. So here's the link between antibiotics and autoimmunity, getting back to Mary's question. Antibiotics kill, you know, all bacteria in the gut, both bad bacteria and good bacteria. But they, you know, over time, antibiotics kill all, you know, a lot of the beneficial bacteria in the gut. And one of the roles of the beneficial bacteria in the gut is to keep the pathogenic bacteria in the gut in check and keep it from overgrowing. So what happens is when you take antibiotics a lot, you end up with an overgrowth of pathogenic bacteria, and that's called intestinal dysbiosis. So these pathogenic bacteria have endotoxins called lipopolysaccharide, and the lipopolysaccharides found in the outer membranes of these gram-negative bacteria. And lipopolysaccharide, or LPS, damage the intestinal tight junctions and destroy the gut barrier, make it leaky. So the gut is designed to keep certain things in, you know, in the gut and excreted, meaning they don't get into the bloodstream. And it's also designed to let, you know, beneficial nutrients in. But when the gut barrier becomes compromised, it just becomes kind of like a sieve, and it loses the ability to keep things out. And then large proteins and food toxins slip into the bloodstream. They trigger an immune reaction. And then, you know, even worse, some of these proteins actually, like gluten, resemble human proteins. So the body begins to produce antibodies against those proteins and starts attacking its own tissues in a case of, you know, mistaken identity. So this is the process by which, you know, taking antibiotics can actually contribute to leaky gut and autoimmune disease. And, you know, leaky gut used to be a quack diagnosis that was, you know, pretty, pretty much limited to, you know, alternative practitioners with ponytails and new age music, you know, in their waiting room.
It seems like just in the last couple of years, it's become legitimate, because I remember not that long ago that it was before sites like yours, before the kind of paleo came. Is it mainstream? I don't know. But before it came more to the public eye, I remember never hearing about leaky gut. And if I did, it was looked at with like
scorn and disdain.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it was like the guaranteed way for you not to be taken seriously would be to walk into a room of doctors and say, "Hey, what about leaky gut?" You know? I mean, but now if it's completely mainstream, in the scientific literature at least, I think still most kind of general practitioners don't know very much about it. But if you look if you go and do a search on PubMed, for example, which is, you know, the database where all the scientific studies are indexed, you'll see 9,000 results if you search for intestinal permeability, which is the medical term for leaky gut. And it's about to get huge. Why? Why do I say that? Because guess what? There's a leaky gut drug in development now.
Awesome.
Awesome.
What is it, composed of glutamine or what? What's it doing?
No, it's actually, I mean, it's more sophisticated than that, but it's designed to prevent the tight junctions from being damaged. I learned about this at a recent seminar with Dr. Karazi, and I can't remember exactly what he said about how it, what the mechanism is, but like I said in the last podcast, drugs don't have side effects, they just have effects. So if you shut down that one function, it's almost guaranteed you're going to be shutting down other functions, because proteins, you know, have a lot of, they usually don't just do one thing, they do other things too. So who knows, maybe it'll be a miracle drug, but I'm not holding my breath for it. My point was that once the big pharma gets involved starts, you know, developing drugs, then the pharmaceutical sales brochures will be printed that have all this information about leaky gut, you know, and then the pharmaceutical sales reps will get in their Ford Tauruses and you know, canvass the doctors and take them to Aruba and, Whistler on ski trips and show them flashy PowerPoint presentations about leaky gut. And then everyone will know about leaky gut. But they'll only know about it in the context of this drug that's available to treat it. Anyways, yeah, you can tell them that. Don't get me started on that. So the next frontier too, a little side note here, is going to be leaky brain. Because the brain, blood brain barrier is the other crucial barrier system in the brain, and we know that the same things that cause leaky gut, you know, the environmental toxins, the food toxins, stress, antibiotics, etc., can contribute to leaky brain, and they often go together, which is why we see behavioral problems, things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ataxia associated with gluten intolerance, but I'll save that for another podcast. most of the research now suggests that to get an autoimmune disease, you basically have to have a triad of factors. You've got to have some genetic predisposition. You've got to have the presence of environmental triggers like gluten, for example, or other food triggers or other environmental toxins. And you got to have a leaky gut. And each of these is a risk factor on its own, but the bulk of the research suggests that those who develop full-fledged autoimmune disease tend to have all three. And specifically, I'm referring to Alessio Fasano's work, who's a fantastic researcher. He's one of my favorite, and he's really established this connection between leaky gut, genes, environmental triggers, and autoimmunity. So that's the connection, and I'm going to be writing a lot more about this in the months to come, and we'll be talking about it, I'm sure, almost every podcast.
It's fascinating. That actually leads us perfectly into Matt's question. Let me go with it. Do you have any recommendations for an optimum diet for good gut health, especially when dealing with dysbiosis, candida, leaky gut, exhausted adrenals, etc.? Ensuring the body is well nourished with the right macronutrient ratios. Pretty much every candida diet out there will recommend low carb based on the assumption that anything that converts to sugar / glucose / fructose, etc. will feed the candida. There seems to be a lot of confusion over carbs, something I'm finding hard to negotiate around. A paleo diet would include some starches such as sweet potatoes and yams, but could these be irritants due to their density? Fruits are promoted in a diet such as SCD, however, they could be problematic for blood sugar levels, fermentation in the gut, and fructose content. Grains and beans have much slower sustained carb release, but are notoriously difficult to digest with all those anti-nutrients. In your clinical experience, where would you compromise with carbs ensuring the least burden on the digestive tract, avoiding things like hypoglycemia, and having the least negative impact on the adrenals that perhaps too low on a low-carb diet can induce? Many thanks.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. Yeah. We could probably spend a whole podcast on that one. But I think I'd like to start, like, rewind a little bit to the first part of the question, which is, this isn't directed at Matt specifically, but when somebody comes into my office and say, I have candida, the first thing I say is, how do you know? Because I'm a little bit wary of that diagnosis. It's thrown around a lot people can't figure out what's going on otherwise. So
seems kind of like a scapegoat.
It is. I mean, it's real. There are certain people who have it, and it's real, but it is also a kind of a scapegoat or a kind of diagnosis of exclusion. Like we've excluded all these other diagnoses and we can't really figure it out, so it must be candida. You can test for candida, and I know some people say the tests aren't accurate. I think if you do a DNA PCR screen for candida and it doesn't come up with significant yeast, it's not that likely that candida is the issue. But anyways, it's kind of a moot point, because the treatment for leaky gut and for bacterial dysbiosis and yeast overgrowth is pretty similar regardless. So but I don't like the idea of people carrying around the notion of candida unless it's really there. And the other problem is that then people tend to go and research candida diets online, and I think a lot of the candida diets are misguided. So anyways, that's just my little candida rant. But I think the best diet for healing the gut is something called the GAPS diet. And that stands for gut and psychology syndrome. I wish she would come up with another name for it, because it doesn't really get it what it's doing completely. But it was created by it's kind of a different version of an updated, improved, in my opinion, version of the specific carbohydrate diet. It was created by Elaine Gottschall and Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride, who I think is a genius and way ahead of her time. Developed this because her son, I think, had autism. She was a physician in Russia. She's in the UK now. And she researched the treatments that were available and just wasn't satisfied at all. And the more she researched, the more she figured out that there was a connection between the gut and leaky gut and brain, which we just talked about is becoming known in the research. She's been at this for years. And, you know, early on, people were just kind of dismissing her theories, but she's definitely been vindicated at this point. So the GAPS diet removes all the primary food toxins, like grain, seed oil, fructose, and soy, of course, but it goes a few steps further. It also removes all polysaccharides, which are the longer chain sugar molecules. So this is where it differs from the paleo diet a little bit, because the starchy tubers, which are allowed, you know, on the paleo diet, or not on the GAPS diet, because the theory is that people who have compromised gut function can't break those longer chain sugars down into the single sugars that pass through, you know, that get digested. and then they become food for pathogenic bacteria in the gut and cause the problems that, you know, people are trying to treat with the GAPS diet. The GAPS diet does not remove fruit, berries and things like that. So it differs then from the sort of standard Candida diet or some Candida diets that remove those things. It also doesn't remove nightshades specifically, which can be an issue with people, especially with autoimmune inflammatory conditions. So what I do with my patients is I usually put them on some version of paleo or GAPS or some combination, really, depending on their symptoms. I see fewer people having problems with starch than I actually see people have problems more with nightshades than starch. So I might be more likely to start with a paleo type of diet, but add the bone broth, which is one of the most important things in the GAPS diet, because of the glycine and, you know, it's collagen rich. It really helps rebuild the intestinal lining. And then if they're not, you know, if I suspect that they need even more, you know, more support or to be even more strict, I might have them do the actual GAPS diet, but take out nightshades and also limit fructose, because 30-40% of people don't really digest fructose very well. That becomes pretty restrictive. So I only use that in the kind of a last resort type of situation when somebody's really in bad shape and, you know, they need immediate intervention. For example, if someone's got Crohn's disease and they're having, you know, 10 to 15 bowel movements a day and they're facing surgery or they're, you know, they're about to start prednisone or something, I'll put them on the GAPS diet and they'll actually just eat meat broth without even any vegetables, because the vegetables can irritate the gut lining and when it's super inflamed. But that's not common. That's only like in a really real crisis situation. Normally for me, it's some combination of GAPS and paleo, may include the starches, may or may not include the nightshades, and generally try to keep fructose pretty low. You can still eat fruit when you're limiting fructose. You just have to eat fruits that have about equal amount of fructose and glucose in them. So that means you'd be staying away from watermelon, stone fruits like peaches, mangoes, papayas, I think there are a couple, apples. But berries and, you know, a lot of the other seasonal fruits are fine.
Yeah, I remember looking at the GAPS diet and was kind of perplexed at the recommendation for fruit and not starches. I didn't quite get it, but mm-hmm. I mean the berries and the equal fructose to glucose makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, I will say that some people don't tolerate starch as well. So, and you know, I understand the mechanism that she's proposing. It's, you know, everything that we absorb, we have to break it down first, right? So theoretically, the longer the chain is of molecules that we need to break down, the more difficult that is going to be for the body. So I get the theory and I see that actually, it's not just a theory. It seems, I've seen it with patients that can't tolerate polysaccharides, you know, like starch. However, I see a lot of patients who really benefit from the GAPS diet and seem to be able to tolerate starches fairly well. That's just my personal experience. You know, I see nightshades, being more of an issue for most people, and I could be wrong, but I don't think that Dr. McBride talks about nightshades much. Maybe she does, but that's more of a paleo, you know, that's pretty common in the paleo world.
Chris, what's your opinion on fermented dairy products? Isn't Natasha Campbell really big on that?
Yeah, I mean, from the start, she's telling you not only to remove the foods that irritate the gut and, you know, cause overgrowth of bad bacteria, but to start rebalancing the intestinal environment with good bacteria. And fermented dairy is one of the ways that she suggests doing that. I'm a big fan of fermented dairy for people who can tolerate it. And But it needs to be done carefully. You know, obviously, if someone has an allergy to casein, which is the protein in dairy, that's not going to work. And sometimes you need to wait until your gut barrier heals enough to where you can tolerate the dairy. Because if you got a leaky gut, it's pretty likely you're going to react to dairy, even if you don't have a true allergy to it, because it's just it's a common cross-reactive protein. So what I have people do sometimes is, you know, they do the intro diet without any dairy for a period of time, and then they add it back in, but extremely slowly. Like I actually have people start with a teaspoon of kefir made from raw milk, and it sounds ridiculous, but it's super potent medicine, and people will sometimes even react to that. And it might take them 6 to 8 months to build up from a teaspoon to like a half a cup a day or a cup a day, which would be more of a therapeutic dose. But if they try to go any faster than that, they get flare-ups and constipation or diarrhea. And so it's really the good news about gut healing is that we know a lot about how to do it now, a lot more than we did in the past. The bad news is it can take a long time. If you've got a seriously compromised gut barrier, we're talking about, you know, 6 months and even longer on a diet like this before you're really back to where you need to be. And that's assuming that the autoimmune condition that caused it isn't just kind of running out of control all the way through that.
It didn't happen overnight, and it's not going to be fixed overnight.
Good point. That's exactly right.
Chris, that is the end of our second episode.
Wow, already?
Okay, that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode. Chris, how can we find more of your work on the internet this week?
Well, next Tuesday, I'm recording a podcast with Rob Wolf and Andy Dees for their Paleo Solution podcast, which I'm really excited about. It's going to be a good time. I'll definitely report on the blog, you know, when it's available. I think sometime later next week or the week after. We did the Growing a Healthy Baby seminar last Sunday. It was really fun. A lot of people showed up. It sold out, actually, which was really exciting. And I've had several requests or questions about whether I'm going to be offering it for people who don't live in the Bay Area. And the answer is yes. I'm planning right now to offer it as a four-week online class, you know, maybe like an hour each week for a period of 4 weeks. So still trying to figure out the technical details there and the best way to do that. I'm also considering a DVD. That's that. And then, you know, I'm about halfway through the 9 Steps to Perfect Health series on my blog. If you haven't checked that out, go to thehealthyskeptic.org and you can catch up with the articles I've already written. Got some good ones on deck. So I think that's it for this week.
It is a solid series, by the way. I think it's fantastic. It's very to the point, and any of the people that wrote in would be highly served by reading your articles.
Yeah, thanks, Danny. It's definitely been, I just wanted, it's kind of an outgrowth of wanting to have one thing to just refer people to. Like, I get all these questions, you know, like, what's your theory on this? What do you think about that? And I just want to be able to go read that, you know, and that's what I think about pretty much everything related to nutrition and health right now. And so my plan is to turn this into an ebook, which would make it even more accessible, just have everything in one place. And I'm really excited about having it all together there. So
awesome. Okay, you can find me at twitter.com/DannyRoddy and my website, DannyRoddy.com. Keep sending us questions at thehealthyskeptic.org, and thanks for listening.
One thing about that before we go, to send a question, when you go to the blog, there's a category at the top in the navigation bar called podcasts. If you click on that, there's a little thing that says click here to send us a question, and then when you click on that, there'll be a form that you fill out and we'll get your question. That's the best way to do it. Make sure that we get it and see that it's a podcast question.
Awesome. Yeah, that question will go straight to me, and then I will index them. Awesome. Chris, do you have anything else?
That's it.
Cool, man.
Thanks, Danny.
Thank you. I'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Take care, guys.